Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Anyways, I'm Sam. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Sam.
And,
Please stand.
No, thank you. That threw me off. I have a sponsor. I begrudgingly worked the steps, and I have a sober date. It is February 19th, 2015, and let me tell you what happened on February 18th in 2015. It was 3 a.m. I was homeless in People's Park, and I was trying to sell marijuana in order to get money for more drugs. And I got jumped by about a gang of 8 middle schoolers for my weed. And let me tell you, they kicked the shit out of me. And they gave me a concussion. I blacked out. And then they rode away on their little, you know, BMX bikes. And, like, I don't know what it was. Like, you know, I've been in fights before. I've been beat up before. I've been homeless for a minute already. But something about that said, you know what? It's time for me to stop using. I think it was mainly because that was my one outlet to get more drugs, like to get more money. And that was it. They stole, like, I had an eighth of weed. They stole it. Then I'll just start quickly from the beginning. I was born in Riverside. My father was a police officer. My mother has a master's in child development. And so I grew up in a very loving, amazing home. And the only thing that really marks, you know, as important in my childhood was I grew up with a lot of fear. When I was like 8, somebody drove up to me. I was playing in the front yard and said, you know, get in my car. And that was an extremely traumatic experience for me. And I grew up with a father who was a police officer. So he'd come home every day and talk about, you know, bad guys. So I had this like very pessimistic view of the world. I was very afraid of religion as well. I grew up religious. So I just had a lot of fear growing up. But that's really the only thing I can think of that's, you know, important to my alcoholism. So because my dad was a cop, I towed the line pretty well until I was 17. When I was 17, I started getting drunk. And that kind of just was just like, oh, man, alcohol is not as terrifying as everybody's been telling me it is. So I wonder what else is pretty cool. So I started experimenting, went to college, and they kicked me out after 3 quarters, and moved back home. I got into popping pills. That was my thing for a long time. I tried to commit suicide, and then I went. Then I started getting institutionalized. I moved up here because I met a woman in my first rehab I went to. And that is another reoccurring theme in my story. I spent the ages like 20 to 23 or 24. I'm not sure. So I spent like 3 years in and out of rehabs. I've been like, you know, like 12 or 14 times in a rehab. What would happen was I wasn't ready to stop using. It wasn't really that bad for me because I discovered like this amazing solution. I'd go there. I did a lot of stupid shit in rehab, you know, for instance, like fall in love. I started doctor shopping while in rehab. And somehow I figured out that, you know, I could get prescribed my drugs of choice and manipulate everybody to let me take them while in rehab. So that never, like, really worked out. And I'm just going to tell, like, one really embarrassing anecdote about my time in rehab that really just, like, nails down how stupid I was. So I was about to go to MPI. I'd just been kicked out of another sober living. But the problem was I had like 40 Xanax pills. I was going the next morning and I was like, there's no way I'm flushing these down the toilet. I can't do it. So what I did, I wrapped them in some plastic and I shoved them up my ass. And I went into a medical detox like with drugs. Because I was just like, you know, I'm not ready to stop using. I have to go get sober. to get off the street, but I'm not, you know. So I got kicked out of there really quickly because I was snorting the pills in the bathroom. And all right, yeah, so that's my rehab experience. That's just what it was, you know, a couple months sober, get kicked out. The last time I got kicked out of a sober living, I'd been injecting heroin and meth for 3 months while living there. And because I was so good at hiding it, I thought, you know, I got this stuff down. You know, I've been living here 3 months, shooting up every single day, and I haven't been kicked out yet. So I just thought it wasn't like, I knew it was a problem for me, but I was just like okay with it because I discovered, you know, like there's no experience like injecting drugs. And so I got kicked out, and then it was like really time to be homeless. So I was homeless in Oakland for a little bit, and then I went to Berkeley. I was homeless there. I got jumped, and then I said, you know, it's time to go. And so I was no longer allowed at rehabs because my insurance company said we've had enough. So I had to start going to county-funded programs. I went to the Newbridge Foundation for about 7 months when I was once again kicked out of that one as well for not following the rules. But I had 7 months sober, and I knew, like, I wasn't going to use again. So what I had to do was I spent that night on the street. Then I went to another county-funded program, Options. And I stayed there for about 5 months. And, yeah, I've been sober ever since. So what's it like today? I don't know. Like, I was pretty young when I started coming to AA, and I saw everybody here. And I thought, what a bunch of fucking squares. I do not want to do anything that they do. You know, they pay their taxes on time. You know, they honk at somebody and then they like ask for forgiveness right away. I do not want to, you know, like I started using drugs to not do that. I wanted to be like, you know, this like rebel type of dude. And so like what I do today, like I just still, you know, kind of do my thing. I just do it sober. And that's been extremely important for me to like discover in this program is that I don't, you know, I'm sober and I can be like whatever I want to be in life. And that's been a really powerful thing for me. Like I said, I do the steps begrudgingly. But you know, I don't really put a lot of faith in, the steps or step work, honestly. I'm an agnostic. I struggle with higher power. I struggle with a lot of like the, powerlessness ideas. And so what I've done is that I just have to be willing to do whatever it takes to stay sober. So I, you know, when people tell me, oh, you should do the steps, even though I don't think they work, I still do them. Even though I don't like praying, I still pray just because it's like showing to myself, look, I'm willing to do whatever it takes. So yeah, I mean, I'm kind of my life today, I'm, you know, I'm broke. All the time. I don't know about this, this 9-step promise about fear from, financial insecurity. I don't have any faith that will ever leave, at this point. But I'm just like really happy in my life. And that's crucial. I found like a really amazing job that I got through the program. Even though I'm a college dropout, I'm a behavioral therapist for children on the autism spectrum. And that has been another amazing thing that this program's given me. That, you know, I'm just happy doing whatever I'm doing every single day because I love going to work. You know, I love the hobbies that I do. And, yeah, it's great. So that's all I got.
Hi, I'm Samantha. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to get double timed. Morgan's timing me, and I'm going to time myself. When we hear this go off, it means I need to start getting sober if I haven't yet. Okay. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Samantha. Hi. Gosh, you guys. So I can easily talk for 40 minutes straight, like easily, like if you wanted me to speak for 5. But because I was asked to speak for 40 minutes, like, of course, I'm really scared that I won't make it to 40 minutes, or it'll be really lopsided. So there's experience, strength, and hope. So do I spend like 10 minutes on experience, 10 minutes on strength, 20 on hope? I don't know. So it'll all come together. So I am going to take a pause and check in with how I feel and invite you guys to do the same thing in silence and to ask yourself if there's anything that you want to get out of the meeting today and just check in with how you're feeling. And if you don't know the word for how you're feeling, that's okay too. So I'm going to do that and speak when I'm ready. You can just watch me breathe if you want. Okay. So I feel a lot of adrenaline coursing through my body. My mouth feels a little dry. I feel kind of amped up in that way. So I guess it's nervousness, but I also feel kind of an excitement underneath that, like a sense of opportunity. And what I want to do is tell the truth. I want to tell the truth, and I would like that to be of service to someone. However, that's not all on me, which is a relief. So, so what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Okay, it was really, really bad. I actually want to start with what it was like now for a second and share that in the last month it's been revealed to me by two different people that I have appeared. The first person told me that I appeared in her psychotic episode during her last relapse and that I was there ushering her back into program. And that, maybe that's my dramatic version of that. But basically I was there being like, what are you doing? You know, in her psychotic episode. And then a week ago, a newcomer told me that she saw me in her dream after she relapsed, you know, like as a representative stand-in for AA. And to me, that's pretty amazing because if, as you'll hear my story, that's insane that, like, I imprinted on someone's subconscious enough that, like, when they're having a psychotic episode or having a dream, like they're in their REM state, that they think of me as some type of representative of AA. I find that very, very funny. And so, yeah, I'm not a representative of AA, by the way. I'm a representative of myself, my experience, and yeah, so there we go. So the truth. So, I grew up in Oakland, California. We moved to Texas when I was 8. We moved back when I was 14. I went to, an all-girls Catholic school and was very sheltered during my high school years. I didn't do any drugs other than alcohol once or twice. Alcohol is a drug. So I thought I didn't do any drugs. I wasn't having sex. I wasn't dating. Pretty much my whole life was academics and sports, and it was very wholesome. I also didn't have a license until I was 19, so I was very, very sheltered. And I did well in school. I have a lot of people here who showed up for me today. I asked you guys to show up because I was worried about sharing for 40 minutes, and I appreciate that because, I don't know, it's interesting when I ask people to come. I need to slow down. Oh, there it is. I feel very sad but moved that I was asked to speak today. Because I've overcome a lot, like with the help of this program. And I'm really humbled by that fact, you know, that you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to be the best. You could just be good enough and you can just tell your story and that's enough. And I'm not used to that. Bringing up high school is what my mind association was with suddenly getting verklempt. Because I was a winner. I was such a fucking winner, right? Like, I have very, very severe ADHD, like, off the charts. Like, I am eligible for Social Security, literally, and have been in the process of deciding whether I want to avail myself of that. I'm very neurally atypical. This is part of my story, so I'm okay with sharing it, even though it's an outside issue. I have a processing disorder that can be called ADHD because that's what's on the books, but it's actually so severe that it almost constitutes a separate processing disorder. And this I learned through the mental health help that I got after being sober. And I learned how severe it was about a year ago. So I take medication for that as well as depression. And I'm learning in sobriety, so thankful to be sober, but I'm learning in sobriety how to get right sized around what my mental health issues are, because I can both use that to completely separate myself from other people, like, oh my God, I have this thing that's like not even ADHD. It's like so much worse than that. Oh my God, woe is me. Or I should never try to work again. I should never try to contribute to society. I should go do drugs and live under a bridge. You know, like I have that side. And then I have the side that's like, you can do anything, Samantha. You're an insane genius. Like, why don't you go do that and save the world and become the first female president? And like somewhere in between is the actual truth. And I don't have a sense of what that truth is without other people there and without my higher power. So I go back to high school. So I had nearly straight A's. I was very sheltered. I was protected from the severity of my condition in part because, you know, I have above average intelligence, but I also had everything taken care of for me. So I wore uniforms. All I had to do was roll out of bed, put on some clothes, go to school. I didn't have choices to make in that regard. I didn't work. My mom drove me everywhere. I had a friend who, when I forgot things, which was constantly, I could call up and she would just tell me what the assignments were, you know, and I was smart enough to succeed, but the showing up part, like the having everything ready part was always difficult, but I had almost codependent relationships with people to protect me from that. So I was raised to believe, hi, that's my sponsor. I was raised to believe that I could do anything, you know, and for the most part, I did do a lot. You know, I got almost straight A's. I did basketball. I did musical theater. I took voice lessons. I had this bright future ahead of me. But I remember getting drunk, really drunk, when I was about 17. And I invited all the girls who were in my friendship circle over, and my parents had gone out of the country, and I thought, I want to be bad. Like, what do they do in the movies, right? That's bad. What would give me a sense of normalcy? So I was like, drinking, you know, I didn't really like drinking very much, but I thought, let's do that. So my friends were game. We got a fake ID. Draw now. We got a fake ID, went to a liquor store in the hood, came back up to the Oakland Hills, and proceeded to get shit-faced. At least I'm pretty sure everyone else got shit-faced, but my perception of that might have been off because I was really shit-faced. So in the course of that night, I remember like shitting myself, confessing to a same-sex curiosity about one of my friends in the friendship circle, and like screaming very loudly for a reason I couldn't tell you why. I just remember like primal screaming. Two, three. Oh yeah, and then also my friend had to put me to bed, one of my friends, and then one of the friends I had in that friendship circle decided to not be my friend anymore, which I said that's because she was like homophobic because of the thing with the other girl. But really it's because I'm an alcoholic and I scared her that badly. So that's one of the things I've been able to see since getting sober. So that's like one of the milder examples of what getting drunk does for me. So I'm going to fast forward and give you just another taste of that. So, but not yet. Because I have ADHD and I'm scattered and I'm nervous. So let me focus on that for just another minute to share with you guys what I was thinking during that. I was given an assignment by my sponsor to go back in my drinking and using history and define like not just what happened on the outside, but what I was thinking. and what I could tell you I was thinking would be something like, because I'm reconstructing it, right? Something like, I want to be out of control. I want to be normal. I want someone to listen to me. And I want to stop thinking. And what I realize now is those other people who I was getting drunk with were likely not having thoughts like that. They were likely wanting to have some fun or just get drunk, right? But they weren't on this, unless one of them shows up in program and then, you know, welcome, but they weren't having what I just framed to you guys as like kind of an existential crisis or angst or whatever that was. I was having that. And I realize now that's because I'm an alcoholic, you know? Other people drink for fun, but they don't drink for escape, or they don't drink out of obsession or compulsion. They don't drink if they don't like drinking. I don't even like how alcohol makes me feel, you know, which is ironic. So that's some of what it was like. Those are the types of thoughts that I was having during one of the more mild incidents. But I want to fast forward to one of my bottoms was, and I might cry, and I accept that ahead of time. Okay, good. Okay, so fast forward. So I didn't drink or use between 17 and college really much. But once I got to college, I had incidents where I didn't drink every day, but I would go to a party that I heard about, like, through Facebook, like, not a friend. You know, I'd go to a party where I barely knew people. I'd go straight to the liquor. I'd get really drunk. I might just go home and pout because people didn't pay enough attention to me, but I might also, I might embarrass myself. Yeah, that happened a few times. I might embarrass myself and just feel totally alienated. I remember going home with someone I was friends with, or she was like helping me to get home because it was time to leave and I wouldn't leave. Oh, I would do that too. I would just like not leave parties because I was so lonely. And I remember talking to her and being like, do you know when you do that thing? I was really high, really drunk. I was like, you know when you do that thing where you're in a group and it's like you can tell that people are talking about you, but they don't want you to know that they're talking about you. They're looking at you. They don't want you to know that because they feel bad for you, but they don't necessarily like you. And I was like going off this whole thing. And I remember looking at her, and her eyes were welling up with tears. And I used to think she was a really good actress, so I went to theater school, but big deal. And I used to think, oh, it's because she's such an amazing actress. Like, she's so present and available. And then later I considered the fact that, like, my story was full of that pathos, like, and kind of that pathetic, which is pathos makes pathetic Latin root. Anyway, like that pathetic, that sad, that she was actually crying, you know, because I did not have the skills to connect with people. I mean, that's the bottom line, you know? Okay. So fast forward to one of my worst bottoms. So, after I graduate college, we'll get there. After I graduate college, I stopped taking my medication. I started thinking maybe ADD wasn't real, and I started reading some books, and I was like, fuck the world, I can do whatever I want, even though I hadn't performed very well academically. I did a shit ton of plays. I never was asked to act with the same director twice, which is, I realize now, like, maybe that wasn't your acting, but maybe that's because you couldn't connect with people, and, like, you had that whole social connection boundaries, it's all about you thing, that's a problem. So I didn't feel good about myself on the inside, and I somehow thought stopping my medication and pretending like I was other people would fix that. And so within a year, I became hooked on marijuana. Like, I was a drug addict with marijuana, but I was in denial about it. I went to my first AA meeting after a coworker broke their anonymity and tried to get me to work that program, and I didn't. So fast forward. So, okay, started with the weed addiction, first AA meeting. Over the course of 6 years, tried a therapist who was like, maybe it's the marijuana. I'm like, no. You know, maybe you need to go to rehab. I went to rehab. I left early because I wasn't on any harder drugs, you know. I went to rehab again. I got kicked out. No, I left this time. I left again. Same rehab. I decided to move into a homeless shelter because I am insane, because I intuitively knew people there would have worse problems than me, and I'll just get hired. I'll get a job, you know, and I'll be able to smoke weed. So I ended up getting a job as a stripper because I knew that, you know, I could get away with doing drugs. And basically within a year or two, I was on meth and I was homeless. So this is not the bottom yet. This is leading to it. So before we get to some hope, which we will get there, I ended up, so I'm in and out of rehab. I ended up homeless in Golden Gate Park. After I was there for a few days in the area, I ended up going off with a man who was soliciting me and did not plan to have this day, guys. Came up to me, basically solicited me. We went and he shot me up and in exchange for my body. And I remember thinking, trigger alert, guys, you can handle it. Talk to your sponsor. Basically, when it comes to the thoughts that I was thinking, this is what I want to share with you guys and hear myself say it. As he was getting me ready, I looked away when he was injecting me. And I remember having the thought, like, you should look. You should make sure it's clean. And I remember having the thought that if I get HIV, I deserve this. Now, that is not normal. That's not healthy, and that's not normal. And I had to really grieve that thought, the fact that I had that thought, like a few weeks ago when my sponsor asked me to do that step work. And I thought that that was the worst, but like I said, I can, 17 minutes, I can look back in my history and see that that was a thought that just got that bad, that grew from that basic just teenage angst and loneliness that was just, I want someone to listen to me, you know, I want to stop thinking so much, I want to be normal, went from that to, I would deserve it if I got a life-threatening illness. And I'm not even going to do the work required of turning my head to ensure that maybe that doesn't happen. You know, so that's what my alcoholism looks like. That's what my addiction looks like. And today is a lot better. But the reason why I bring that up is because I still have access to that dark side. It's there for me. As soon as I take a drink or a drug, it is there for me. You know, and I don't think I present like that most of the time. You know, I'm a pretty extroverted person. I like to be around people. I'm not too introverted or moody. I mean, I have my moments, but that's not like, I wouldn't say that's how I am all the time. But for that specific reason, that's why I need to speak up and share that I have had thoughts like that and that I know I can in sobriety when it gets really dark, because we're all the same. I mean, that's the disease. It's not me, but it is the disease. You know, it wants me dead, and I believe that. So I'm going to start talking about other things. So, okay, so 4 years ago, I got a sponsor. So this is 6 years after being exposed to AA. I got a sponsor for the first time, and I worked the steps. Oof. By the grace of God. And I got better. I've been sober for 4 years. I've been through, I think, 4 or 5 sponsors now. I've always had a sponsor, whether I was getting along with that person or not. You know, I had one, and I recommend that if you're new, please avail yourself of one. You don't have to let it get that bad. That's another thing. You know, if you're here and you haven't had that shit happen, that's actually really great. That's good. That means you love yourself. You don't have to wait till it gets worse. And the truth is, if you're here, it probably, like, is that bad already on the inside, even if it's wearing different clothes. I want to say that because it's only been since working the steps that I look back and I realize how much I was hurting, and that I get to catch up with my own feelings and, like, cry over it now safely, you know. Which is part of the healing process. So 4 years ago, I got sober. My parents took me in after I was kicked out of my last treatment center for the second time. They let me stay with them even though I relapsed a couple times. And I went to the dark side again. But what I originally wanted to share is that I actually have their trust in a way that I didn't before. And that's a really beautiful thing. You know, I was able to ask my sister, who passed of cancer. I have 3 siblings. One of them passed about a year ago. I was able to ask that particular sister for forgiveness and to make amends for the way I treated her when I was drinking and using. And I'm so grateful for that, because without that, I don't know if I would be able to stay sober with that hanging over my head and her dying of cancer and, like, me, this addict who went through all alcoholic, I use that interchangeably, who went through all of that, who put myself through all of that, who came from the Oakland Hills and had private school and all this, and ending up, like, under a bridge and prostituting myself. Like, I was not feeling okay about all that shit, you guys, you know? And to have my sister, who is an angel, tell me, you know, that all she wanted me to do was to stay sober and forgive me like that is really beautiful and is one of the gifts of this program. I don't know what your guys' miracle is going to look like, but that was a miracle for me. That's one of them. The other thing I want to share is that I had, how am I doing on time? 7 minutes, thank you. I had another instance where I was working on my fourth step work, and I was missing a boyfriend who was on that fourth step, an ex. And I was in a part of Oakland where they, you know, Oakland's big. I was in a part of Oakland where they normally aren't and that I'd never actually been before. And I was sad after writing the fourth step and looking at my part with him. And I was with a friend, and I was, like, you know, pouting. And she said, she's like, "What's wrong?" And I was like, "I miss." And I said his name out loud. And then from across the street, I hear, "Did you say?" And it's his name. And he starts to walk up to me. And I'm like, he reaches in the car, and I go, "Go, go, go!" And she, like, drove off. To me, that's a miracle. Because that guy wasn't good for me. You know, he sold drugs. He wanted to cheat on his current girlfriend with me. Like, and this is the person, like, 5 seconds before I was so sad for it. And then seriously, wasn't my thought, was maybe a higher power thought, I think, that got me the fuck out of there. That's a miracle. It's a little more lighthearted. About 2 months ago, 3 months ago, I showed up to a dance workshop, and there was an audition for a fashion show at the workshop, and I wasn't planning to do it, and I told my dance teacher who was there, like, "Oh, I would do it, but I don't have the right shoes." All the women were wearing black and high heels, and she's like, "Just do it," you know? So she pushed me. I wanted to, but I wouldn't have admitted it. So she pushed me, you know, into doing it. I didn't have the right heels. I was wearing, like, tennies or something, like something not unlike what I'm wearing now. And then it turns out I wear 11 and a half. Follow me, people. It's going to make sense. I wear 11 and a half, which is very large and atypical for a woman and not easy to fit. And my male dance teacher who has done drag had shoes big enough to fit my feet. So he went and got the shoes. Suddenly I have high heels. Turns out I had an extra change of black clothes, and I ended up getting cast to model in the Bay's biggest hair fashion show pop-up mall. Like, I did not plan that. I might have wanted that, but I would have gotten in my own way if anything had turned out differently, if I hadn't shown up late and overpacked my clothes because I didn't have time to decide what to wear, if my dance teacher hadn't encouraged me, if my other dance teacher didn't have the shoes, I wouldn't do it. Like, what is that? You know? I don't know what that is. Now, some people might think that's self-centered for me to be like, "It was God, it was Jesus, he wanted me to model." You know? But that's okay for you to think that. Because I feel really good thinking that maybe it's because someone was being nice to me. You know? Like, I feel like God was being really nice to me that day. That's one of the cool things that happened. I was kicked out of my previous housing situation, and because I've been homeless and because I have, you know, that insecure side, I was totally wrecked. I felt like I might drink or use. I've thought something's wrong with me, like they don't want me to live with them. And this is an example of something that was turned to good because I ended up, now I'm living alone in a beautiful apartment that I'm getting help with from my parents, which is one of the things that the previous roommates, like, teased me over. It was stupid, but basically they were willing to help me live in a nicer place and alone because of that shit that happened at the former place. And then I realized, since being away from them, that, like, they're all sick. They were all smoking weed and doing drugs, and I didn't even realize, like, how much that affected their perception of me or me of them. So the ninth step promises. So one of the promises in the ninth step promises is that we will suddenly realize God is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. So for me, all of those things that I shared with you are examples of things that can happen if you stay sober. You know, and you don't have to believe in God. I get it. Like, if you don't believe in God, that's fine. I get it. I read Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, and I used to be a fucking atheist and blah, blah, blah. And I was talking about God and all that shit when I was underneath the bridge. 10 minutes? Jeez. And frankly, that's all it got me. That's all that got me, not believing in God and being stubborn and even not God love, like the benevolent forces in the universe that want to help you, that want you to stop doing drugs and alcohol, like, come to this side, come to this side. It was there all the time, and I just said no until those things happened that I told you guys about. And I'm one of the lucky ones. A lot of us end up with diseases or dead or killing ourselves or other people. So I consider myself fortunate that that didn't have to happen. All of that other stuff that happened, it hurts. But truthfully, I'm grateful. I'm grateful because that's what it took for me to realize that I don't got this on my own. Okay, so I want to talk about the second step. Whew. Ooh, that felt good. Telling the truth feels good today. Ooh, segue to the first step. So the first step, which precedes the second step, is admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. My current sponsor has pointed out to me that there, although we read the ninth step promises in the meeting, so when people say promises, they associate that with the ninth step. There's actually promises for every step. And if you read the big book or the 12 and 12 in mine, you can see promises embedded in them. One of the promises of the first step, according to Samantha, because my sponsor made me do my own mining, even though I wanted to Google it or have her tell me what it was, according to the first step, is that you'll see a connection between honesty and strength. So for me to admit that I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, same thing, and not be afraid of that and see that to break past the denial that put me in those situations that I told you guys about, to me is a miracle and is a promise that has been fulfilled. Not only just the unmanageability of the drugs and alcohol, but of the horrible things that happened. I'm able to say that, and I know I'm going to be okay. Like, I know it might feel a little uncomfortable to admit these things, but I know, like, after this meeting, Leah's going to hug me, Rachel's going to hug me, you're going to hug me. Hugs from other people as well are welcome. You know, I'm going to be okay because I have people to hold me and support me, but also because I'm not as insecure as I used to be. I'd rather tell the truth and live than lie to myself and lose my life. Or self-respect. That's a promise. Second step is what I wanted to talk about before stopping. Second step, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So there's a few in here. One is, and please do read the literature. Don't just take my word for it. I'm doing my best, I'm paraphrasing, but one of the promises of step two is the most obvious, that you'll come to believe in a power greater than yourself. Another is that sanity is possible. And not only is it possible, but it is for you. Like, sanity is an option for me today. And I believe that. It makes me want to laugh, like, especially after sharing all that shit. But, like, I too can be sane, you know? I mean, I am sane. This is a sane version of me, guys. And I believe that it can get better, you know, that's what I'm promised in the second step, and that's happening. But here's another promise that people don't talk about in the second step. It's that you'll relax. Yeah. So, yeah, it literally, guys. So page 26. Okay, page 26, second paragraph of the 12 Steps, 12 Traditions. Well, says the newcomer, I know you're telling me the truth. It's no doubt a fact that AA is full of people who once believed as I do, but just how in these circumstances does a fellow take it easy? That's what I want to know. And this is to a newcomer who's like, I don't believe in God. How can AA be for me? I know I'm an alcoholic, but God, blah. That, says the sponsor, is a very good question indeed. I can tell you exactly how to relax. You won't have to work at it very hard either. Thank you. Listen, if you will, to these three statements. First, Alcoholics Anonymous does not demand that you believe anything. All of its 12 steps are but suggestions. Second, to get sober and to stay sober, you don't have to swallow all of step 2 right now. Looking back, I find that I took it piecemeal myself. Third, all you really need is a truly open mind. Here are where the directions come in. Just resign from the debating society and quit bothering yourself. Quit bothering yourself. Bothering is the word they use. Yourself with such deep questions as whether it was the hen or the egg that came first. Again, I say all you need is the open mind. So, this is such a terrible demand to ask of an alcoholic, but it's saying, if you don't think so much, if you don't ask the deep questions, you'll feel better. You'll relax. And that has come true for me. It's not that I don't ask the deep questions per se. I think about race all the time and gender and my place in society, blah, 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 because I'm so deep. But I don't necessarily think that of that as like a sign of being deep anymore. I think of it as I'm just inclined to ruminate, and that can be quite a beautiful gift. But that can also become very dark very quickly when I'm taking the problems of the entire world on my shoulders. So the fact that someone like me is able to relax, is able to be like, I don't know if God exists or not, but I don't have to find the answer. I'm going to set that over here. I'm going to come into AA, work these steps and see what happens. That's a miracle. And the other miracle, which I can honestly, this is true for me, is I really am starting to believe in God. And I'm happy. Good for me. Good for AA. And I love you guys. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.